All right, good afternoon, everybody. It is Thursday afternoon, April 1st, 12:40. And we're going to continue doing a little bit NMR. And I had some problems that I wanted to show you with a couple of different ideas in them. Things different than what we've been doing in the labs and what different than what we did in the lecture on Tuesday. And I think this is going to be the last day for NMR for examples like this, and then we'll pick it up and we'll start going into mass spec on Tuesday. And while we're going into mass spec, I have some assignments for you guys to do. I have a co-op for you guys to do. I'll have a quiz for you guys to be able to do that'll be NMR based. So there'll be a couple of assignments there for the NMR itself. And then as we get through mass spec, then we'll start putting them all together. And we'll also go through a refresher for IR, because I know that you guys did a little bit of IR last semester with Zaruba, but we'll go over it again real quick and make sure that everybody's on the same page with IR. And then we'll have a day or two where we do problems that are from scratch, all the way going through IR, mass spec, and NMR, and how to put it all together. So right now, as we're going through the NMR, you're given the formula and we work off the formula, and it would be very difficult and challenging to do without being given the formula. So the formula is sort of a required component. But as we move into going into mass spec is where you get the formula. And so you use the mass spec data to be able to get the molecular formula. And from there, we start to go into the NMR and start putting it all together. There's other things that we can get out of the mass spec data as well. There's some other really helpful information that's in mass spec, but the main thing that you get out of it is the molecular formula. Okay, so now that I've sort of hit everything that we want to do, let me go ahead and screen share my iPad. And I want to start a new note in the lecture. And the problem that I want to do, I now lost. Shoot, I know where I want to go. So I want to go to chemed.study. And the web spectra problems. And I want to start off with an intermediate problem. I want to start off with number 7, I believe. This is a pretty small problem. It's C4H6O. So there's not a whole lot to this at C4H6O. And you would think that this would not be that complicated a problem. Why is it in the intermediate section with this small formula? Well, let's find out. Let's first start C4H6O, and this is number 7 on web spectra. This is intermediate problem. So notice when you go to web spectra that the numbers start over again. So if I go back to the website, in the beginning section, they are 1 through 30. In the intermediate section, they are 1 through 16, and then intermediate 2, 1 through 13. They keep starting the numbers over again. So if you're trying to track with the lecture, make sure that you're on intermediate 1, number 7. That's what we're looking at. So I should say intermediate 1, block number 7. Okay, first thing is what? What do we do here? Oh, chat would be good too, so that I could see what you guys are saying. Or, you know, you could always do it by voice too. There's not that many of us, and this is a pretty easy class to manage if you want to unmute. Yep, Bogey's got it, units of unsaturation. Drew's got it as well. That's what I'm looking for. So what do we have? How many units of unsat do we have in this? 2 units. It looks like it. Did I get the formula right, first of all? And am I looking at the right problem? Because I wasn't anticipating 2 units. C4H6O. All right, it is what it is. Hopefully this is the right problem now. Now I don't know what the solution is, so we'll find out what it is as we go through and do it. Yes, it is CnH2n plus 2 plus every one for nitrogen and subtract one for every halogen. And so where n equals the number of carbons. And so we've got H2 times 4 plus 2. And we've only got H6. So we subtract those 6. We got 4. You divide that by 2, and that gives you your 2 units. So that's where we're at. Okay, let's go grab the spectra and look at the proton spectrum first. And this is looking like the right problem, I think. Let's zoom in on this area here. That's what I was looking at last night. So I think we're in good shape. Okay, so I'm bouncing back and forth between a couple of things just to get an idea of what's here. First off, notice that around 2.05 and 2.15, there are some little bumps that are there. Those little bumps are not integrated. Sometimes within a sample, there are impurities within the sample. The impurities may show up in the spectra. And the technicians know to look for those impurities and will not integrate them. So we're only looking at the signals that have been integrated on this website. So don't get fooled by anything that hasn't been integrated. So we're just looking at the peaks that are integrated. And what I want to do is I want to screenshot this, and then I will bring this in, and then I will zoom, do a blow up of each little section. And then I want to center here. And I think that's everybody in that little section. So let's get that. And as I was telling the folks this morning, when we were in lab this morning, I do all this work for you. So when I give you spectra, I usually give you better spectra than this. I give you actual integration values, so you don't have to fight to figure out what the integration values are. And I give you the details so that you don't have to zoom in yourself to try to figure out what the details are. This guy's a singlet. We really don't need this one, but sometimes it's helpful just so there's no questions later. Okay, everybody's in Notability. Let's go see what we've got. So what I want to do is take the full spectrum. And I'm going to move it down towards the bottom of the page so that we can write up above it. And I want to also grab these details. And bring them in. And then let's see if I can line these up and crop this one. Because we only really need to see that that's a singlet. Okay, so there's what's going on. And then when you see an NMR that is worked up this way, frequently what they will do is they will take and put lines that show you sort of the detail blow up of what you're looking at. Like this. So you know that that's a zoomed in section. Okay, so when we start this process, this morning we went through this quite a bit, but for the afternoon section, the first thing that I like to do is start off by making my table and figuring out my number of H environments. So we come down here and we look to see how many environments there actually are in terms of different chemical environments, which sometimes is easy and sometimes is not. You can't always go by the integration values themselves. The integration values sometimes show you what a single proton is and sometimes not. And so you have to be careful what you're looking against. The singlet here, that's obviously one. This guy is integrated together and it looks like a doublet. This guy is integrated together and it looks like a doublet. And this guy is integrated together, but I'm not sure exactly what that is just yet. And so if I were counting here, I would just count, and I'm going to go by the integration values and the way they've integrated it. This is one environment, a second, a third, and a fourth, and then I only have four chemical environments that are in this list. But what we'll do is we'll leave that open, that there could be more. And so one of the things that I said this morning too was that when you're working through this data, sometimes there are questions. When you question a piece of data, don't get stuck on it. Don't sit there and try to figure it out until you absolutely know what it is. If you question it, put a question mark on it, come back to it later, reassess it, move forward, keep moving forward, find a way to move forward. That's the name of the game. That if you get too stuck, then you never find a way to move forward and you don't resolve these. Okay, then in the table, we're gonna have parts per million or chemical shift. You can list it either way. We have the integration value. I like to call the next thing just the multiplicity, or you can call it spin, or you can call it spin-spin coupling, whatever it is you want to call it. After that, it is the number of neighbors. And then finally, an assignment. And so we go through and we just pull out each piece of data, and the numbers don't have to be perfect. We can zoom in to get a little bit better value if we need to in terms of the detail. 2.2 is close enough to the first one here. So we can just call that 2.2. There's nothing else next to it. If there's nothing else next to it, I just kind of round out the number to make it easy. When I have a doublet like this, what I tend to do is I tend to pick the number that's centered on the doublet. So rather than picking each peak, if it's a clear doublet that's like that, then this is 5.8, 5.81, 5.82, 5.83, and it's centered on 5.83. The next one, if I assume that the next one is a doublet, sort of find that center mark there, I would just call that 6.12 and just round it out. And then this one, the last one, depending on what we're calling this or what this is looking like, and we're going to investigate what this is in more detail, but this is looking, if I center that grouping right in here, that's 6.2, almost 6.24. And I'll list it out as such, 6.24. Okay, now we need to figure out what these things, what their integration values are. So with the integration values, what we want to do is we want to find the shortest bars. So we look at these guys over here that are short. And if I take and build a scale, and then I grab that, and build a ruler out of it. And I oftentimes, when I teach this in the classroom, I'm projecting this on a screen in the classroom. And what I do is I literally walk up to the screen with a piece of paper in my hand. I use the same Sharpie marker that I use on the whiteboard, on the piece of paper, overlaid onto the projection screen. And I just mark this, I line it up with it, and I mark it on the piece of paper. And then I move that piece of paper around and I check to see how it aligns with the others. And it usually is a very quick, easy way to go through and make a ruler in order to be able to gauge the height of all the peaks. So if we assume that this guy here, which was our starting height, was 1, and these other two, if I compare the height from the start of the bar to the bottom of the bar, they're each equal to 1. So it looks like these are 1 to 1 to 1, and the terminal end over here looks like it's 3. Everybody agree with the integration values? The way that I put that together? Okay, so it looks like I'm integrating 3 to 1 to 1 to 1. And if I had come out with something that was like a half, like if I tried to do one of these guys that was a half, then I would have to multiply everything by 2 to bring that up to 1. For instance, let's say that I thought that these were different protons that were here. If these were different protons, then my integrations would look like this. They would look like 0.5, 0.5, 1, 1, and 3. And I would have to multiply all of those by 2 in order to get them to ratios of 1 to 1 to 2 to 2 to 6. But that 1 to 1, if I add them all up, 1 plus 1 is 2, plus 2 is 4, plus another 2 is 6, plus 6 is 12. This would be 12 protons. It doesn't check out. It's too many. What I was expecting was 6. And so the ratios that I have in red, which are 1 to 1 to 1 to 3, is 3 plus 3, which is 6. That's the right ratio. And so we always have to check and make sure that we're coming out with the right number of protons in our integration as we go through and integrate everything. Okay. I'm going to get rid of the blue because I feel like that's going to be confusing if I leave it. So we've come out with 6 protons. Okay. The integrations are there. Multiplicities. First one is a singlet, right? So how many neighbors does a singlet have? 0. BB's got it. The assignment I'm going to come back and do in a minute. This one looks like a doublet. So that guy's a doublet. How many neighbors does a doublet have? Just 1. Good. Okay. And then the next one here looks like a doublet as well. Now these doublets are roofing. Let me do the roofing in blue. We'll show the roofing there on those two doublets. Now, notice that they're roofing in the same direction. They're both roofing downfield. If they're both roofing downfield, they can't be splitting one another. So whatever is splitting these two guys is occurring downfield. And that makes sense because when we look downfield, the direction of roofing that I see is in that direction. And if I go short peak to long peak, it's also in that direction. So they're roofing together. Okay, so we've got another doublet with one neighbor. And then what looks like the wrong ratios, but because of the roofing, maybe the roofing is skewing the ratios. And so what I would look at this and say is that this is four peaks. The ratios are all off. If it were a quartet would be 1:3 to 3:1. It's not a quartet. And so with four peaks in the pattern that is there, it's looking like in some way, this is some sort of double doublet. We'll have to sort that out in a minute. And that is hard to see. And part of what I wanted to show you is something that is non-standard, that doesn't look like anything that we've seen yet. That's not a simple pattern. And if this is indeed a double doublet, how many neighbors does it have? How do we describe the number of neighbors? What does it mean to be a double doublet? A double doublet usually exists as a proton that has two neighbors. And these two neighbors have different J values. So we can call this A, B, and C. These two J values, let's call it JAB and JBC. When JAB does not equal JAC or BC, that equals a double doublet. It just means that the two J values are different. Would exam question difficult to be approximately at, below, or above this problem? Approximately at this problem level, but a larger molecule. So there would be more, this would be a component of the molecule, but there would be some other things in the molecule that would need to be resolved as well. What I want to show you, what I want to get to eventually, is how to sort all this out. But first off, how do I describe how many neighbors B has, HB? How many neighbors would you say it has? It's got two. Pokey, I agree. And so I say two, but I oftentimes write this as a 1+1, meaning that they have two different J values. Because if you just say two neighbors, then with two neighbors, you would expect a triplet. But because the J values are different, I like to distinguish this between something else by saying that it's got 1+1 neighbor. One neighbor in one environment, one neighbor in another environment that is causing it to split and be different. So that was the way that I wanted to describe that. And I wanted to make sure that I showed you guys that. Okay, let's take a look at the chemical shift. The shift for this guy, which is three protons in the same chemical environment, is out at 2.2. At 2.2, this is downfield of where I would normally see sort of an alkyl group. Let me grab the proton table. I was using it this morning. And the easiest way to get a hold of it is to go back to the lab notes from this morning and grab it. That guy. Okay, so here's our proton NMR table. And what we're looking at is we're looking at 2.2 something in this range. We're just outside of where most alkyl groups come. And we're in the range where this is something that has an electron withdrawing group next to it, but not necessarily on it. By that, I mean, when you look at these electron withdrawing groups, the proton is on an alkynyl proton, on an alkynyl carbon. The proton is adjacent to a carbonyl. The proton is adjacent to a carbon-carbon double bond or benzylic, adjacent to an aromatic ring. When you get up to high twos, threes, and fours, this is where the proton is on the carbon with an electron withdrawing group. So the electron withdrawing group is near the carbon, but not necessarily on the carbon. I don't get too locked into that. What I do is I simply say that this is something that has an electron withdrawing group attached, and then I list the type of carbon. Now, do you guys remember from lecture yesterday how I listed out the types of carbons? If it were three in the same chemical environment, what do I normally term that as? What type of group? Methyl group, good. I'm seeing some different people answering, so that's excellent. CH3 group. So this is an electron withdrawing group that's attached to a CH3 group in some way. Okay, 5.8, 6.1, 6.2. Let's go take a look at the table. Okay, so 5.8 and 6.2 and up in this range. These guys here are all in the range of carbon-carbon double bonds. And these look like a carbon-carbon double bond type. Now we could say that they might be an NH or an OH, but the difference here is that these tend to be broad, whereas these guys tend to be sharp in terms of the peak. These exchange. These do not exchange. Okay. So differences between hydroxyls and amines and protons on those and the protons on carbons. So the protons on carbons do not exchange and tend to be sharp, whereas the protons that are on hydroxyls and amines tend to be more broad and tend to exchange. So looking at these, all three of these are in the range of being attached to a carbon-carbon double bond. And that's everything that we get out of the proton NMR. We're not getting a whole lot else. We can come back and we can do some analysis on this in a minute, but that's what we're getting out of this. Let's go take a look at the carbon NMR. When you're done and you kind of have all the information that you can get, it's time to move on to the next piece of information and start diagnosing that piece of information. And typically, I'll tell you too, I work in a very nonlinear, I work both in a linear fashion and a nonlinear fashion kind of simultaneously. One of the first things that I do is I like to look at both the spectra. I like to get an intuition about what it is I'm looking at, what functional groups I might be there. And then I start building out my tables and filling out my tables after I've sort of looked at everything to get an idea of what's there. And then I write down everything. And then I take all my pieces and try to assemble my pieces. So I kind of go back and forth. Let's go grab the carbon. See what we're looking at. So here's the carbon NMR. I think if we zoom in on these peaks, they're all going to be single peaks. And indeed, they are all single peaks with the exception of this thicker line that's here. That one's a triplet. So that one's different. And that one, if we look at the number, is coming out at 77.2. That 77.2, that is CDCl3, that's the solvent. And so recognizing CDCl3 and that thick line that is three peaks at 77.2 is an important thing to recognize. So let me grab this and bring it in. We won't need to blow up any details because there's no details to really see. Now, sometimes they change the solvent on you. Where do they list the solvent? Let me show you. If I go back to the problem, they list the solvent right under the formula. It says CDCl3. And if in doubt where the solvent shows up, you can go back to Web Spectra, back to notes on NMR solvents that's here. And here they have all the shifts of the solvents and where you find them. And so this is kind of nice too, just to check your solvent and mark your solvent early so you know where your solvent is. All right, so chloroform here. Chloroform shows up in the carbon NMR at 77.2 as a triplet. So that's where we're at. All right. Back to here. We're going to take our carbon NMR. We'll blow it up. We'll mark our solvent really quick. And then we'll start our table. I guess I put that way far down from where it needed to be. We'll start our table up here. C13, NMR table. We'll get our number of carbon environments. How many environments am I looking at? Four, good. And our formula was C4H6O. So we're seeing all of the carbons. That's always nice when you're seeing all the carbons. What happens when you don't see all the carbons? Let's say that that the molecule had four carbons and I only see two. Oftentimes, that implies that there's symmetry in the molecule and that some of the carbons have the same chemical environment. And so you're not seeing them all. It can also be, well, okay, so I see some faces. Let's say that this formula is C3H6O. But when I look at the number of chemical environments, it has number of H environments equals one, and the number of carbon environments equals two. And yet there are three carbons. And so by symmetry, because the molecule is symmetrical, sometimes you don't see all the carbons. And so when you have a carbon NMR that lists less than the number in the formula, you have to start thinking symmetry. Or the other possibility is that sometimes on a molecule such as this, the quaternary carbon sometimes disappears and drops out. Quaternary carbons have such slow relaxation times that sometimes the quaternary carbons do not show up in the NMR unless we do a particular type of experiment. And so if not all of the carbons are showing up, it's one of these two issues. Either it's a quaternary carbon and it's dropping out, or symmetry. And by symmetry, we have to figure out the symmetry within the molecule. So again, we're doing a slightly deeper dive than what we've done before. I keep adding things to it. I'm hoping that you've had a little bit of time to absorb and practice some of the other skills that we worked on. And now we're like throwing things on top. It's like the bonfire. We just keep chucking stuff on to make the fire bigger. Okay. So let's go ahead, now that we've got the number of environments, let's list these out. This is 10, 20, looks like 28. Oh, should header this out too. This is parts per million. And the assignment. Sometimes within the carbon, you can get some splitting information. But when you don't, you only have the two lists. You have the parts per million and you have the assignment. So we were at 28. Next one occurs at 110, 20, looks like 129. If that's 29, that's 30, that's like 38, 138. And then the last one out here is at 200. And that's all four carbons. Assignments. We need the carbon NMR table. Okay, with the carbon NMR table, when we're looking at this guy over here, that's our 28. 28 on the table puts us right in here. This is the normal sort of carbon-carbon range. Normal alkyl. And so I don't know what that thing is, but I know that it's just alkyl carbon. It's a carbon with no electron withdrawing groups on it. And when I go back up to my list up here, because I already did my proton, the one that had the farthest upfield was this guy, was the methyl. That's probably what that thing is that guy is probably the methyl. So they usually correlate. In terms of the peaks there. Okay, 129, 138. 129 and 138 puts me in this range here. This is the carbon-carbon double bond range and the aromatic range, but with only four carbons, I can't be aromatic. So that puts me in the carbon-carbon double bond range in this guy. So these are looking like the two carbons of a double bond. And then the 200 range, 200 is putting me all the way up here. 200 is putting me in the carbonyl range. So that is likely to be my two units of unsaturation, which is helpful. And the way that I just did this might be misleading. So I'm going to erase the bonds off of that and just say that this is just the carbonyl. So I only have these four carbons, a methyl, a double bond, and the carbonyl, and I need to figure out how this all goes together. So let's take those pieces and see what we can do with it. So we've got a double bond. We've got the methyl group. And we've got the carbonyl. And we have three more protons that I need to be concerned with that are somehow on this double bond. And so when I have a double bond that is like this, I don't know what my configuration is. So this line that cuts through the middle is saying, I don't know what the configuration is of that just yet. But with three protons, it can only really go, I suppose, one direction, one way. That all three protons, since they're double bond protons, have to be on that. And then the only way to get the carbonyl in there and the methyl, since all other parts of this are taken up, is to go ahead and put in the carbonyl and the methyl. And any other combination that I try to do, and maybe we could just play with this for a second, is that if I try to look at any other combination, I can play with other things, but they're going to have problems. And so this is one way to get it. I suppose I could get it this way. And there's one more way that I could put together. And that way is to do that way. Okay. So these are all the possible compounds that I could consider as conceivable ways of putting this together. They don't all fit with the data because I know that when I go back up to my proton NMR, my proton NMR shows me that I have three of these protons that are on the double bond. And so the three protons are being shown as being on the double bond. And each of these molecules that I have proposed that only have two on the double bond all have this functional group in common. They're all aldehydes. And an aldehyde proton has a very specific chemical shift. If we go back up and we look at the proton NMR, actually, I don't think it's on the proton NMR. It is. There we go. It's right here between 9 and 10. This is where aldehydes show up, between 9 and 10. And so the expectation is that these guys would be somewhere around maybe 9.5. And I don't see that. There's no proton integrating. Let's go back to the spectrum and look. There's no proton out here around 9.5 that's integrating for one proton. And so that knocks out all those aldehydes as being possible molecules. Now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to be able to understand the splitting pattern that is arising from this. So let's take this guy and let's analyze this a little bit more. Okay. Let's call this A, B, C, and D. All right. A is going to be a singlet. It has no J3 neighbors. Do you guys see that? That when I look at HA, that it would be one bond to the carbon. This would be the second bond, third bond, fourth bond. This would be a J4 to the nearest, and that's a long-range coupling constant. So there's no J3s. But then when I look at the protons that are on the double bond, the protons on the double bond have 1, 2, 3. There's a J3. They have 1, 2. That's a J2. And then if I use green, 1, 2, 3. That's a J3. So I have a J3 here. I have a J3 here. And here I have a J2. These protons couple at very specific ranges. Let me draw a couple of different double bonds for you. The biggest coupling constant is a trans. This J3 equals between 12 and 18 hertz and is always that really big, large coupling constant. A cis coupling constant. You would think that this would be a bigger coupling constant. It's a J3, but this J3 usually runs 6 to 12 hertz. And then the last one, the geminal coupling constant, the J2. This J2 runs 0 to 2 hertz. And those are the ranges that we see within double bonds like this or alkenes. So that means that when I look at all of these protons out here, that these ranges here, this is going to equal 6 to 12 hertz. This is going to equal 12 to 18. And this one's going to equal 0 to 2. Which means that when I look at what pattern I expect out of these, I could look at the pattern that I expect for HB, HC, and HD. Let's just take HB for a minute and look at HB. HB is coupled with a large coupling constant of 12 to 18 hertz to HD. So we'll make this the large coupling constant. This is going out to HD, and let's just say that this is 18 hertz. HB is also coupled to HC at 6 to 12 hertz. So at 12 hertz, this would not quite come all the way back in. And if this is 12 and 12, and this is the coupling with HC, then the pattern that I expect to see is a 1 to 1 to 1 to 1. And this is a double doublet. Does that make sense in how I diagram that out? And in fact, all of these guys, this would be a double doublet, HC would be a double doublet, and HD would be a double doublet, depending on the coupling constants. They would be different types of double doublets. They would look different, but they would all be double doublets from that pattern. Let's go back and look and see what's happening in the spectrum. And I think what I want to do is I want to copy the entire spectrum, bring it down. I don't want to write anything more on top of it. I just want to grab this whole thing here for us to look at. I think it copied what I didn't want. Try one more time. See what it gives me. Oh, that's what I got to do. I got to paste image. So I can't, if I just copy and paste, I get everything editable. Okay. This is not going to work for me. One more time. What I'm trying to get. It's just this piece. Okay. Much better. All right, these are the alkene system. And what I want to show you is we talked about the roofing already, right? We said that these guys, this one here was roofing that way. This one's clearly roofing that way. And these guys are roofing that way. So they're splitting each other. But the question is, how are they splitting each other? I usually do this with a piece of paper. And just as I was saying, when I measure the heights of these integration bars, and I use a piece of paper to construct a ruler and measure the heights of the integration bars, I do the same thing for the J value, for the splitting value. So what I do is I go in and I use a piece of paper and I construct a line. And I try to line it up with the top of the peak so that I'm getting the peak just right. And if you need to zoom in a little bit, you can zoom in and get it right where you need it. Copy that. Paste another one in. Take that line there. Get it right on the peak. Now this becomes your ruler that we're going to use to look for that J value. And so what we do is we take this and we move it over and we say, are these guys splitting each other? And if the J value is different, if the peaks don't align, then they're not splitting each other. And so these two peaks, this guy here and this guy here, are not splitting each other. So we move down the line and we say, all right, there is that J value. I can see that those two peaks have that same J value, same distance between them. And these two peaks have that same distance between them. So these guys here are being split by this neighbor down here. Now there's another J value in here. I want to find this J value. Let's say that this is the large J value. And I'm going to take that one and I'm going to look for that one down here. Those two peaks. And those two peaks. See how the J value is reflected in these two peaks here? This is the larger J value that is the trans J value. This one is the smaller. This is the cis J value. And how it's being reflected in these protons and what I'm not seeing is I'm not seeing these guys are doublets instead of double doublets. I'm not seeing that geminal J value. I'm not seeing that 0 to 2 hertz J value. The 0 to 2 hertz J value is dropping out. And so here's what it's looking like. Here's what's happening. My molecule looks like this. And these two protons here are coupling. And let me swing that around the other way. These two protons are coupling, and these two protons are coupling. And what's not happening is I'm not getting a coupling between these two here. And so what's happening is this is the double doublet being split by two. This is the large. This is the small. And this one is missing. And so what happens is this one becomes a doublet, wrong printing, doublet, doublet, and double doublet. And so if I list these protons out and I look at, we said this one was B, C, and D. Did I label them correctly? Yes, I did. Those protons are the double doublet is proton B. The doublet with the large coupling constant is going to come from this coupling constant right here, the large, that's HD, that has the large distance between them. And the one that has the small distance between them, that's HC. And that's how they map out. Okay, why did I want to show this to you? Because these kind of systems are common. We see them quite frequently. And being able to understand double bonds and how the protons arrange across a double bond and how to track J values and to sort out and find neighbors and find which protons are coupling to which protons. What that's showing me is that I can map this out. I can say B is coupled to D, and this is the large coupling constant. And B is also coupled to C, and this is the small coupling constant. That's causing the one proton B to split C into a doublet, the one proton B to split D into a doublet, and C and D are the 1+1 system that split B into the double doublet. How are we doing? Making sense out of it? Sort of. You're wondering, how can I do this on my own? This is going to suck. It could suck. It's not that bad. Oftentimes, as I said, oftentimes you can sort out the different possibilities by simply what's not there, as in the aldehyde. The aldehyde excludes these three and gives you only one possibility. You do not need to go into the amount of detail that I just went into in order to find the correct answer. It's nice to understand it so that you can recognize it and see it. And when you see it again, something in your brain will trigger, oh, wait, I've seen this. That can be extraordinarily helpful, but you don't necessarily have to pull out all these tools to figure out the right answer. This tool, however, of taking a coupling constant and drawing it from just the peaks and then moving it around to find where it's reproduced elsewhere in the spectrum can be very helpful to figure out which protons are coupled to which protons. They can be very helpful to figuring out which ones are near neighbors. JC, hopefully that spinning wheel doesn't stay there too long. Okay, what questions did I generate in terms of looking at this problem? If any.
Honestly, up until like the coupling, I guess the new information, everything went pretty smooth. I'm just trying to digest that new bit. And so more practice with that part isolated, if possible, I think would help.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, let me choose another problem. Looking at the time and seeing what we've got. 19. I want to do 19 on a different website. So let me switch websites on you. This is one that I normally do in class because it just really helps with what I want to teach you guys. It's a done. This is the easiest way to go back. Let's do organic structure elucidation, do the problems. And it's 19, I believe. 19 is a moderate problem. Now, this website does not have answers. Do the problems. 19. Okay. This is C9H7NO4. And so without problems on this one, or without answers on this one, you're going to have to trust me. I didn't show you the answer on the last one. I probably should have, but you can trust me on the last one too. C9H7NO4. Let's start it off. What do we do? So this is number 19. Ooh, a lot of notes. On this website is called the Organic Structure Elucidation website. Okay, so C9H7NO4. This has us practicing all kinds of things. Okay, I got really lucky with this COVID vaccine. I haven't had a fever. I haven't had any nausea. I'm a little tired, but what I do have is joint pain is crazy. My hands are like not happy right now. I think my Tylenol's worn off. 7 units of UNSAT. Yeah, let's see what we've got. So to do this one, it's H2N plus 2. Plus 1 for every nitrogen, minus 1 for every halogen. That's for saturation. So what we've got is we've got 2 times 9 is 18, plus 2 is 20, plus 1 for the nitrogen is 21. So we're at 21. We subtract 7. That gives us 14. Divide by 2, that's 7 units. So nice, JC, BB, you guys got it right. Okay, with 7 units of unsaturation and only 9 carbons, what do we want to consider here? BB does the circle. Let me get just the circle. That's code word for aromatic. Benzene ring, yes. So aromatic, however, when we're looking at aromatic, aromatic is only 4 units. So that means that I've got another 3 units floating around, and I'll have to find those 3 other units when I start going through and looking at all the rest of the things that are in this molecule. Let's get the proton NMR and see what we're looking at. 3 carbonyls maybe, could be. HNMR, now this is 500 megahertz NMR. The other NMR that we were looking at was probably 200 or 250. 200 and 250 does not have a whole lot of resolution in it, but when we look at 500, look at the resolution that we get in 500. These are nice crisp lines, and they're giving me J values between the peaks. and they're giving me integrations, this is more along the lines of what I give you. This helps tremendously so that you don't have to sort through and try to figure out what the J values are and all that other stuff. So if the J values are important, I will list them for you so you don't have to figure them out yourself. Now, let's go ahead and screenshot this and then we'll do the detail. And then I want to grab that detail here. Also, the solvent is different in this. I'll zoom back and show you in a minute. They changed solvents on us. Where did I see that? I saw it. Here, DMSO D6, 500 megahertz NMR. The DMSO D6 is telling you the solvent that the NMR is run in. So it's not the same as CDCL3. There will be other solvent lines that we'll have to contend with. But fortunately, they're integrating just those things that we need to pay attention to. So when we go back here and we take this guy, and blow it up. Come on. And then we take this detail and we can throw it over here. Or that didn't work so well. Can I see? Hiding now. They don't have ways to push things forwards and backwards in this very easily. So you have to kind of map things out, not overlapping. Okay, that's a little bit better. And that's my detail spectrum. Okay. These guys over here. Solvent. Oh, and that's not solvent. That last one, this is TMS. Tetramethyl silane. That's the thing that's marking the zero peak. So that's our reference. But what's really important to note is don't lose track of this guy. That guy is really important. Because it's easy to miss it. It's easy to skip it when we go through and do the table. All right, how many chemical environments are we talking about? If we start up here and we assume that everything that is integrated, this is one, this is one, this is two, this is two. So this is one environment, two, three, four. And the exchanges would be five. So there's five chemical environments in the proton NMR. Come on. Okay, parts per million. Integration, multiplicity, number of neighbors, and assignment. Keep everything organized. Keep it always in the same order. Just makes it easier for you. So zooming in on these guys, we can round this out to 6.2, and it's close enough. 6.2, one hydrogen. Just first thing, list them out. Second one, 15 hertz coupling constant, one proton at 7.2. Integration one, doublet, one neighbor. Oh, and these were both 15 hertz. When you have coupling constants, it's kind of nice to track them. They're kind enough to give them to you. You should write them down. All right, then I got two at 7.44 and 7.66. These are each two, and these are doublets, and these were at 8 hertz. Number of neighbors, they each have one. Okay, what's nice about this is that because they're giving you the coupling constants, you can tell which protons are talking to each other, because they'll have the same J value. When they have the same J value, those protons are splitting each other. So by giving you the J value, you automatically know which ones are our neighbors. The other thing is, when we go up here and we look at these guys, here's the other nice part. Look at the way that they are roofing. So this guy is roofing downfield. That means that something downfield has to be roofing back its way and splitting it. So these guys have to be splitting each other. And this one is roofing upfield. So the only other proton that's upfield is this one. They're roofing towards each other. And so these guys are neighbors of each other, just kind of nice to be able to sort out. All right, oh, and I almost forgot the one, right? The one that exchanges. So if this is 8, 9, 10, 11, this is like 11.5. So this is all the way up at 11.5. It's one proton, it's a singlet, it exchanges. And so now we can get the table, and we can start going through the table and start figuring out what everything is, right? So in figuring out what these are, where is that proton table? Come on, little table. Ooh, I just combined notes between two different lectures, didn't I? Copy. I went to lab notes. That will mess us up when I go to report it for you guys to follow later. Just grab the wrong thing there too. I want these two pages. Copy. Paste. Delete. And I'll sort out the rest of this later. Copy. Okay, now we're in the right spot. And this guy is a duplicate and it needs to go away. Notes cleaned up. Okay, I need that proton table. Okay, let's deal with the one that exchanges first out at 11.5. The only thing that comes out at 11.5 out in this range is this guy here, carboxylic acid. So this that exchanges out at this point, that's the carboxylic acid. So that gives me another unit of unsaturation and also finds my exchanging proton, which is really nice, and deals with two of my oxygens. Now the other guys out at 7.4, 7.6, 6.2, 7.2, when I look in these ranges, the ones that are in the early seven range, can be either carbon-carbon double bond or aromatic. But the aromatic range extends up higher than the carbon-carbon double bond. So if I assume that, and I look at this, and I say 8 hertz here, this 8 hertz at 7.44 and 7.66, those guys are up out of my carbon-carbon double bond range. They're in my aromatic range. So these two are looking like they're aromatic hydrogens. And these two look like they're looking like double bond protons. And with double bond protons and 15 hertz, I can figure out what type of double bond they are. Remember, we just went through the double bond things. So at 15 hertz, am I looking at trans, cis, or geminal?
I have a quick question.
Yes.
Why aren't they like the, oh my gosh, the vanillic like hydroxyl group?
Because when we look at this, these guys here are out of range to be in the carbon-carbon double bond. They're much more in the range of aromatic protons than anything else. And when I look at the numbers of them, it looks like I have four that are aromatic and two that are carbon-carbon double bonds, which means that I'm looking at, as I bring all this together, I'm looking at something that has a carbon-carbon double bond, some sort of pattern in that way. I have a carboxylic acid and I have an aromatic ring that is disubstituted X and Y, and I need to figure out the disubstitution pattern. And this would give me two protons. This gives me the one, and this gives me four that are adding up to my seven protons total. And if I were looking at something where I had a group R out here, I would come out with different ratios. I'd have to have three that were on the double bond. And then that would give me another substituent on the aromatic ring. And I would have to find a third substituent so that there would only be three aromatic protons. And with three aromatic protons, I would have to have X, Y, and then somewhere Z, a third group. And I'm not seeing a third group just yet. And in addition to this, what I'm being told is that this is 15 hertz. And at 15 hertz, I know that this must be a trans configuration. Okay, What are we missing? We've done everything that's in the proton, and everything that is in the proton has come out to this. We have found, let's do the number of carbons. 6 carbons, 1 carbon, 2 carbons. I have found CC9. I have found H7. I have found O2. And what I was given was C9, H7, NO4. So what I'm missing, so far, is NO2, 2 oxygens and the nitrogen is what I'm missing. You know what a common configuration is for a nitrogen and 2 oxygens? Nitro group. Yes. And so that's likely to be, now I need to look at some spectroscopic evidence for that to see where that is, but that's likely to be what I'm missing. Now let's talk about this aromatic ring for a second. Remember the 3 possible configurations of aromatic ring systems with 2 substituents on them? We can have X and Y. We can have X and Y that are meta, and X and Y that are para. Do you remember what these look like proton-wise and what to look for in order to distinguish each one? This one is the easy one, AA prime, BB prime, by symmetry. This one looks like the inverted quartet. This one has a proton that is by itself and becomes a singlet. So in this one, we're looking to try to find the singlet. And then oftentimes we'll get a triplet and 2 doublets in terms of what comes out of that. And the last one, we usually get 2 triplets and 2 doublets in some pattern. And so the things that we look for, or we look for this singlet, or we look for this AA prime, BB prime system and the symmetry in that system. And if it's not that, then we fall back on this. So let's go back and look and see what those aromatic protons look like. There's the detail. These are the aromatics. These are the carbon-carbon double bond. Zooming in on these guys, they look really symmetrical as 2 doublets. They don't look like the inverted quartets per se, but it's clearly not a singlet. So here's the thing that we do. It's clearly not this one. It's clearly not triplets and doublets. The only thing that it could possibly be with that much symmetry is the AA prime, BB prime system. So let me take everything and throw everything together for you. We have X and Y on an A prime, B prime system. We have a trans double bond because it's 15 hertz. We have a carboxylic acid, which is attached at the carbonyl. And we have a nitro group. And those are all the parts. And with all those parts, notice that there are no methyls. Which means that these two guys have to be chain terminators, because otherwise there would have to be a methyl chain terminator someplace in order to put this all together. So we bring all those parts together and we come up with two options. Option A and option B. I'm so tempted. I know I'm 8 minutes over and I didn't want to quite go over this far. I'm so tempted to leave you guys with a cliffhanger. But now you need to know, right? This is like a must-know situation. How do we resolve this? How do we resolve which one of these is right? Oh my goodness. This is where the skill set that I was teaching you guys on Tuesday comes into play. What we need to do is we need to predict what we can about these two pictures and then compare them to the spectrum. And we need to decide which is the bigger electron withdrawing group, the nitro group or the carboxylic acid. A nitrogen, which is sp2 hybridized, positively charged with two oxygens on it, or a carbonyl with two oxygens on it. What do you think is the more electron withdrawing? I'll do it this way again. A nitrogen with a positive charge, which is sp2 hybridized.
Nitrogen.
Versus a carbonyl that has the two, and the carbon is sp2 hybridized. It's the nitrogen with the positive charge. That's the stronger electron withdrawing group. Okay, so now that we know what the stronger electron withdrawing group is, now we can predict downfield and upfield. Okay, so watch this. Now what we do is we say, all right, nitro is my stronger electron withdrawing group. And the carbonyl is weaker. So when I take a look at the proton NMR, one way to identify this is in the proton NMR, and one way to identify this is in the carbon NMR. These two protons will be close if the weaker electron withdrawing group is on the terminal end. These two protons will be farther apart. So in the proton NMR, what I would expect to see is that I would expect to see that the doublets are really far apart and that this is the one with the nitro group on it. It is pulling it way downfield, and I'm looking at the distance that these guys are far apart. This is in the HNMR. Over here on this one, those two doublets are going to be close together. And this would be the one that has the weaker electron withdrawing group on it. And these guys would be close. In the carbon NMR, it's the same thing. In the carbon NMR, I would have to identify the double bond and the aromatic ring. And this takes just a little bit more time just to show you. In the carbon NMR, what I'm going to have is I'm going to have these two carbons, which are going to be downfield being close together, upfield being close together. So these would be the double bond carbons. And then the aromatic carbons would have a little short guy, two taller guys, and then a short guy way far downfield. And this would be the carbon that the nitro group is on. On the other molecule, the carbons would be far apart for the double bond, because this guy down here would be the one that has the nitro group on it. And the short and long carbons down here, these would be the aromatics, which would be closer together because it would have the weaker electron withdrawing group on the carbon that would not pull it so far downfield as this one would. So we could tell it both in the proton NMR and the carbon NMR, and the carbon a little bit easier. And we haven't even looked at the carbon yet. So let me just go show you the picture and show you where things are, and you can decide which one of these is the right one. Here it comes, drum roll. Show me the carbon. Okay, in the carbon, the 167 is the carboxylic acid. So everything is in here that I'm worried about. The 123.9, whoops, the 129.3, those are the carbon-carbon double bond ones. And what I'm seeing is that the aromatic ones have this great big gap in between the aromatic ones, which are all the shorter ones. That great big gap, the 147, is the one that's got the nitro group on it. It's pulled way downfield and looks more like this picture than it does like this picture. This is where predicting and trying to figure out comes into play. You need to find how to distinguish between the two possibilities. And in the proton NMR, if we go back and look at that one, where are you, buddy? Here it is. There is a pretty big gap here, but the aromatics are close together. And if that nitro group were on the aromatic, no, I take that back. I was just about to say that wrong. We can't do it well by the proton because the nitro group doesn't have a proton that is next to it. The nitro group is on the ring and makes a tertiary carbon, so that there's no proton that is on this guy. So the best thing to do is to look at the carbon NMR and look at this carbon and this carbon and these two carbons and track it in the carbon NMR. And that's what we did. And that's why we're going for this guy. I'll go back, I'll look at it one more time. Maybe even screenshot it and see if I can bring this in quickly. Okay. So what I'm saying here is that these two are the carbon-carbon double bonds, and that the one on the right is the one with the carboxylic acid on it. And the one, excuse me, that's the left. And the one on the right is the one with the aromatic ring on it. This guy Dogs barking, phones ringing, class is apparently over. This guy is that guy, which is way downfield. And these two are very similar. And this last one, take it back. I don't like that. Green, height, I like that. And then this last one is that guy there. More than likely, that's how that's working out. And it's the distance that's between the 147 and the others that really puts that nitro group. Let's see what I did here that did not make sense. There we go. That's better. Keegan's worried. Don't be worried, Keegan. Okay. Some parting words here. Partly this is my fault and I should have done this one first, but I wanted to show the double-double bond one and I didn't have enough time to go through both of them. And I thought I could go through both at the same time and it was a little bit too much to put into one lecture. And I didn't get to do this one to the degree that I normally like to do it and to walk through it. It's not as bad as it looks in terms of finding the parts. What's lacking right now is the practice. What you guys need to do is you guys need to take the ball now and you need to run with it and you need to do some more practice. So what I want you to do, realistically, what I want you to do practice-wise is I want you to go over here to the Web Spectra website. And realistically, I want you to work through as many of these beginning compounds as you can. So out of those first 30, optimally, it'd be nice within the next week if you could work through 3/4 of these. Yeah, it takes some time. Keegan, see that face? Work through 3/4 of these. Try and get through them, all right? Second thing I want you to do is after working those, and I'll put this into the Canvas shell as well so that you got it. After working those, then what I want you to do is I have a co-op, nuclear magnetic resonance. And here I have 3 problems on organic structure elucidation that I want you to do and turn in. And so I want these worked up and turned in, and these are co-ops where you work together. And then I'll also have a quiz that will be a reasonable quiz for you guys to do as well. Not all in the next week, but I mean, you'll have more time than that. But if you want to get good at NMR, because we're moving on to mass spec next week, I want you to work on those problems. And when you get stuck, I want you to come into office hours and ask me questions and how to fix it. Okay? That's the only way you're going to learn this. You can't learn it by watching. You can't just watch me do it. You got to practice it. That's what it comes down to. Okay? I'll write that all into the Canvas shell. I'll send it out in an email. You'll have it clearly delineated and I'll put clear due dates on it to give you enough time to be able to complete everything.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah.
Do most of these only have the answer or do they include like explanation as well?
The ones that are on the website that are here on Web Spectra, they only have an answer. They don't have you can look at the answers this way where you can see them all at the same time, or each problem you can say view the solution and it'll show you the solution for each one. It doesn't give you a worked out solution. It only gives you the solution itself. For the first couple of them, if you're struggling, go ahead and look at the solution and reverse engineer it. Get used to it, but work towards not looking at the solution until you actually get a final answer. and figuring out how everything goes together. And if you can't figure out a problem, that's where we come together and I'll try to walk through it with you. We'll try to figure it out. Okay? All right, it was a long lecture, I apologize. But I wanted to get through that. I felt that was kind of good to get through. All right, I need to go rest. My body is killing me now. I'll check in with the afternoon lab. If I'm not feeling, I'm starting to like feel like I might have a fever now, as I was saying, I don't have a fever. I'll check back in a little bit and I'll log in at 3 o'clock and we'll have a conversation whether or not I think I can do this or not. So go ahead and log in at 3 o'clock for the afternoon lab and we'll see if I'm in shape to do it, okay?
We could always watch the morning lab.
You certainly could. The morning lab one was good. We had a good session this morning and there was a lot of good information there and I can get that posted. So if that's the case, maybe that's the way we fall back on. All right. I'll check back in with you guys in a little bit. Thanks. Thanks for sticking with me.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you guys.
Thanks also.
You're welcome, Keegan. Bebe.
Hey.
Hey, I'm sorry I missed you the other day. It sounded like you had good questions too.
Oh, I mean, I just worked through, I think I got through like number 11 or something. Or
sweet.
But I can't seem to actually, it's like I'm trying to build Frankenstein's monster, except I put the feet in the arm sockets.
I love that.
Over and over and over again, like I can't figure out how they attach.